I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello everybody, and thanks so much for joining us again for another Motorsport Magazine podcast, and we have a cracker for you today. He was a Grand Prix driver, he's won Le Mans 5 times, and he's always associated with the Goodwood Revival, which is where we are today. Well, we're not at the Revival today, we're at Goodwood today, obviously, ahead of the brand new members meeting, so we're all sitting around a table in the comfort of the Goodwood Hotel. Thank you very much, Lord March. Welcome, Manuel Ipiro.
Well, hello. Because this is a podcast, actually, I can't say good morning, I can't say good afternoon, so I will say ciao to everybody. I'm really, really proud to be here because I listen to all the podcasts, and actually it's a great, great team of people. And I'm very, very proud to be a guest of your program.
Thank you very much. Fantastic. Well, we love it that you're here as well. Just before we get underway, let me tell you about our latest subscription offer. You can get up to 6 editions absolutely free when you subscribe. You can either get 30 magazines for the price of 24 or 15 for the price of 12. But either way, you get 6 magazines completely free, which is good.
I would give 7 completely free just because, you know, you have an Italian guest, it's a good gesture, why not? But even 6 is a jolly good deal, so you should do it, you guys should do it.
Bravo, Manuele, grazie.
I'm glad it counts on here.
Grazie. As I was trying to say...
I think you're going to have to cut that out, Alan, yes.
No, I don't think we're going to cut that out. I think that's all good fun. That's what we expect when Pirro's in the room. Okay, there are various options available, as ever. There's the usual print magazine, of course, but there's also the digital version. And you can also get both and access to the new online archive, which includes every single article ever published in Motorsport magazine since the year 1924. You probably read the first one, Manuele, didn't you, in 1924?
Actually, I was born in 1925, so...
Ah, okay.
Quite a few teammates would laugh, because obviously, okay, with Alan McNish and Frank Biller, we pull each other's leg about the age pretty severely.
We can say anything we like about Nish Capello and co in here, can't we? Okay. Manuele, thank you so much for joining us. You've had rather a long trip from Rome, I gather, but anyway, well done.
Well, sometimes the distance between Rome and the UK stretches a little bit, like today. It depends on the air traffic control and other tricks. But I'm really, really proud to be here. I really mean it, but Motorsport is a great magazine, and the more I grow up, the more I look back, actually, and the more I appreciate the history of motor racing, and the more I appreciate the articles that you guys write.
Thank you. Well, you're a part of motor racing history now, so that's all good, isn't it?
It's all bad, but if I was a part of motor racing future, I would feel a lot happier, but that's the way it is, you know.
It's probably a good time for me to point out, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I first met you 30 years ago this month. It was the International Trophy at Silverstone 1984.
Yes, and if you remember the difference between now and then, it's from the forehead up. There was quite a significant difference.
Yeah. Okay, okay,
but we were both very young.
Okay, Manuel, you're here, of course, to drive at the Goodwood members meeting, the first ever members meeting, which starts tomorrow morning. Tell us what you're driving.
Well, first, I'm telling you that I'm head of Turbolton House, so please support us. I will be driving a Ford Capri, which is actually, I had to go a couple of weeks ago, and it's a very, very cool car, because I have driven, thank God, quite a lot of historic cars. Thank God and thank Lord March. Well, in this order.
Same sort of thing, really. Yes.
And which sometimes you really get, of course, you always get very excited, but sometimes also very nervous, because you are sitting in a piece of history, which is worth, forget about the money, but it's just a piece of history which cannot be replaced. And this always makes me drive, say, at 95%. I don't really like to talk about percentages, but always with on the back of my mind to be careful and to not to crash, not to make a damage. With this with these cars like the Capri, because it's a younger car, I feel you can push this car a little more. It's just a few years before I actually started, and I'm sure you have studied my career very well before inviting me, but I started with of course with single seaters, but early in 85 I also besides single seaters have been driving saloon cars with a BMW 635. So these kind of cars were quite similar, so I really feel like I can push these cars a little more, which is actually giving me a lot of satisfaction, because I miss real racing a lot, and historic racing is beautiful, fantastic, is a dream, but it doesn't give me the true adrenaline of real racing, because you don't really, I'm not able to squeeze the last drop of juice, just because I respect the cars too much.
Okay, before we go on to talk about your career, which is, as we know, a long and amazingly successful one, I must just ask you one more question about Goodwood, because one of the reasons that you're so adored by the Goodwood crowd is because you completely...
My Italian accent, I know.
not your accent. Is because you understand that it's entertainment. And when you won the Tourist Trophy race in Bernie Carl's E-Type Jaguar, you have just got to tell us the story of the end of that race, because it's a wonderful story. If I could just remind you, what you did was, having crossed the line as the winner, you then decided to sort of halfway around almost get out of the car.
Yes, it is true, and I don't know why I have this kind of instinct, which first time I did it when I won the Nürburgring 24 Hours in 1987, just hanging out of the car. But this is obviously it's not acting, it's just a way to express my joy, and because I feel so blessed to be doing what I'm doing. If I wasn't a racing driver, I would be here as a fan, and I would be on pole position to ask for autographs. So every single day I feel so happy that I feel like it's almost a duty to share this joy and happiness with other people. And this is probably my way of expressing it. So I just went out of the car, which is an exercise. I've done it before, so no danger. And because also the people at Goodwood... I mean, I love Italian people, but you guys have a passion, have a competence for racing. So, and because I've been here many times, I feel really close to the crowd, and I also feel that they kind of feel sympathy for me. So I just went out of the car, removed my helmet, and nearly said hi to every single spectator, which I actually did in Le Mans. But this is the next story we talk about, because it's worth mentioning. So it was really nice, a lot of happiness, everybody happy. I started stop at start and finish, and Dario Franchitti was my teammate. You know, we hug and we're very happy, and Lord March. And then Lord March said, it was so nice of you. Why don't you both step in the car, one each side, and do another parade lap, which was quite nice. There were nice photos. We both happy and everything okay. Until towards later in the day, I'm called by the stewards and I thought, what did I do wrong? Normally, not that I've been always good, but I always try to be good. And what did I do wrong? I didn't remember anything wrong. So I went there with, you know, polite, like I used to be. I said, yeah, this is me. And then I said, sit down. Okay, I sit down. There was my chair and four guys in front of me, and they pointed the finger at me and they said, you have broken all the rules. So first I actually turned back because I thought there was somebody else behind me and they were pointing to somebody else. And then I was alone. So I thought, I am Emanuele Pirro. I was driving car number. Are you sure you want to talk to me? Yes. So I thought I might be in cadet camera. I don't know, but I wasn't. To cut the story short, all the rules that I broke were I drove without safety belts, without helmet, with half of the body in the car and half of the body out of the car, although it was at 20 miles per hour. So they were really angry. I wasn't pleased because I thought this was a nice gesture, but at the end of the day I said, well, if you really want, please fine. And they said, we need to fine you. And then I said, how rich is the owner of, who owns the car? I said, the American fellow. And said, how rich is he? I don't know. Do you think 5,000 will do? I said, please. By then I was really getting a little bit annoyed. I said, please, gentlemen, if you feel appropriate, do what you want. I didn't want to offend anybody, but feel free. So I get fined. I tell the story to Bernie Carlo, who is a very, very smart American lawyer. And what he did, and actually Charles Marsh was quite embarrassed about this, but I understand the stewards. I don't want to speak bad about them, especially because now I am one of the stewards. No, because, you know, if they felt it was dangerous, maybe they didn't know how much in control everything was, but, you know, okay. So Bernie Carlo was writing an unbelievable fax at the time, there was no other mean, saying, you have to understand that motor racing is lacking of people like Emanuele Pirro, who are showing so much enthusiasm, is getting so dry and so boring, and you should reward people like him. Blah, blah, blah. But anyway, we accept your fine, but I enclose a check of £10,000 because he's going to do exactly the same next year. And he said, what?
Bravo, Bernie Carl, eh?
No, actually, the way you wrote it, of course, I can't repeat it, but it's been brilliant, brilliant.
It's a great story. Okay.
And we were talking about Le Mans before because first time we won Le Mans, I was lucky enough to be in the car at the end. And, you know, the last lap is actually a parade lap because, although it's still a race lap, but basically the race freezes the lap before, and it was such an unbelievable feeling, and so many people, I mean, you guys want to see, everybody who is listening should go to Le Mans to see what the feeling is when you do the last lap and everybody, all the marshals with the flags, and it's an unbelievable atmosphere, and it's the time where you start realizing what you've achieved. So I must admit I was a little bit too slow. It must have taken like 10 minutes and I grabbed the flag and everything. So for the following year, they made a new rule, which was nicknamed Lex Pirro, that you have to drive the last lap no longer than twice as long as your fastest lap in the race, just to stop me that. And moreover, I was kind of hanging out of the car with half of the body in a sign of happiness. The next year, lucky enough, I was again in the car when we won, and I was further out of the car, and I wanted to do something more special the third year, and I don't know if you guys remember, but I was completely standing on the seat like a motorbike rider, and coming out I hit with my knee the steering wheel, and I nearly fell off the car, but I didn't, thank God. Sometimes you need a little bit of luck. So, and I was completely standing, and then I got a real how do you say?
Bollocking.
Yeah, this is what I wanted to say, but I wanted to find a polite synonymous. But anyway, yes. And so I had to apologize, and I had to promise I would never do again, which because I had step 4, version 4.0, which was an unbelievable trick that I never told anybody and I will never do. And although I won one more time, I wasn't able. Anyway, to cut the story short, Daniel Poisneau, a few years later, because he was the guy who really gave me a hard time, we were drinking a nice glass of wine in California, Laguna Seca, and he said, you know what, Emanuele, I have to admit, I had to give you bollocks, but you I really liked it, and you were really good, so I support you. So I felt yes, thank you.
Right, I think all of you out there are now getting the idea, aren't you?
just before we move off Goodwood, what tips would you give someone who's never ever raced there and is racing there tomorrow? You're looking at them at the moment, yeah.
I think what I always tell myself: respect yourself, respect the car you're driving, respect other people, enjoy every single meter you're doing, and drive within your possibilities and capabilities. This is what I would say. But above all, enjoy, because it's an unbelievable privilege, even if you drive a Fiat Cinquecento, with all respect for the Fiat Cinquecento, but you know, to be here and drive around is an unbelievable privilege. So yeah, respect yourself and the others, I would say.
Right, I'll be doing that then. I'm doing that. Sorry, Rob.
No, it's okay. Let's get the ball rolling round the table with Nigel Roebuck and Simon Aaron, and of course Ed Foster, who we've just heard from. Le Mans, 5 times a winner. Fantastic. It's a fantastic. I mean, to win it once is amazing. To win it 5 times, fantastic.
Actually, it's even more fantastic because I drove Le Mans once in 1981 as a kid. Because the year before is the year I started motor racing with the Formula Fiat Abarth 2-liter, which was similar to Formula Ford, brand new championship, lots of young drivers, and this was my first season in motor racing. I won this championship, and Fiat Lancia Group as a reward. The next year I did the Formula 3 European Championship, but Cesare Fiorio asked me if I wanted to drive in their squad, which it's a little bit like Audi now. You know, Martini Lancia was an unbelievable team in those days, and the other drivers were my heroes, you know, Riccardo Patrese, Eddie Cheever, Andrea De Cesaris, Piercarlo Ghinzani, Michele Alboreto. I was a kid and I felt unbelievable. So I was invited to drive Daytona, which eventually we won this race, and for me it was my first ever race outside Italy. And then I was invited to do Le Mans, and just a couple of years ago, just thinking back with a little bit more maturity, I kept good terms with Cesare Fiorio, and I called him up and I said, you know, Cesare, I just went through an interview and about what we did, and I really realized, which at the time I didn't, how brave you were to take me without testing, without anything, after a 20 minutes race of former Fiat Abarth straight into a 24-hour race, Daytona, with no chicane. I said, I just want to thank you after 30 years, because you have been so brave and so courageous. I wouldn't do it to a young kid like I was, because I said I was just a kid. And he said, yeah, Emanuele, but I was just a kid too. That's why I did it.
So you must have been asked this 1,000 times, but what are the secrets of winning Le Mans so many times? I mean, there's Jackie Eakes, there's Tom Christensen, obviously. There's a few of you who've just done it time and time again.
For me, every time I won this race, I always said biggest secret is a lot of luck, because basically you have a lot of situations or occasions where you can throw the race away, but there is very little you can do to win it apart from doing your job properly. It's a race where you start putting bricks one on top of each other to build the wall of victory. Since a long time before, in testing, preparing the car, building up a good team atmosphere, which is one of the strengths of Audi, because Audi, if you remember, not every year. Now it's got an image of unbelievable, unbeatable car, but not every year we were driving the fastest car, if you remember. I'm sure you know which years I'm talking about. Yeah. But the squad was, our strength was our team, our trust into each other, our preparation, our on-track operation with Team Joost, and the healthy rivalry between drivers, you know. So it's a long process of preparation, and I think one of the credits I have to give to Audi and Dr. Rurik is that he kept the same people for a long time. So with Frank Bila and Tom, my first three wins, and Marco Werner afterwards, you know, you are driving with people that you would give your the key of your life to them. You know, there is such a big trust between each other. Nobody wants to show he's better than the other. When I set up the car, I do it in function of the others, and so they do. This is really, for me, all you can do to win the race. Everything else, you are in the hands I mean, there are so many people who lost races that have been already won, and it's a difficult question. Yeah. Every time I won the race, I look up because I believe in God, and I said, "Thanks, mate. Thanks, mate."
Okay. I'm sorry to hog the questions, but Nigel and Simon, please butt in. But just one more for me, and that is, when you look back on your career, do you have regrets about your Formula One, your Grand Prix career?
I am an incurable optimistic, I have to say. So to speak about regrets, it's quite hard. But one thing probably I have is, which was a regret in one hand, but I think a good choice on the other hand, because when I started to race, my dream was Formula One, obviously, but I realized how difficult it was, and I thought, I don't really know if I'm going to make it. Because also I always questioned about my ability. I've always been very hard on myself and always looked where I can improve and not what I have done. So this attitude actually made me always probably underestimate a little bit myself rather than overestimate. So the question was always, am I good enough for that? Besides, will I have the right lack of opportunity? So when I was doing Formula 3000 my first year, I had a call from BMW Motorsport because my friends Roberto Ravaglia and Gerhard Berger were already drivers, and touring cars in those days was, on my eyes, something for old people. But I drove the 635, really nice car. I realized that this could be a very good way to continue racing, a very good plan B. So what I did was always, and actually it was quite easy for me to drive these cars. I was quite good. Sorry about being immodest, but it came.
Record speaks for itself.
So I thought, I have to do this, just in case plan A doesn't work. So I kept driving touring cars beside my single seaters career. And when I got actually into Formula One, I continued driving for BMW. So in my first year of Formula One, I drove for Benetton. That year, I took 108 flights. One plane every 3.3 days. I was living in Suzuka. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, every second week, I was testing the McLaren. I was racing the Benetton. I was still continuing doing the Formula 3000 Championship in Japan and the Grand Champion Championship, and doing the races with BMW in Europe. So to cut the story short, which is not really one of my best abilities, the regret is that I didn't put all my energy in a discipline which is already very difficult by itself, even if you give 100%. Not that I didn't give 100%, but two things. Once, my body size was really not good for the Formula One cars of these
too
days.
Too tall.
Too tall, especially with the Benetton. And I had a lot of problems with my knees, and I was booking the rooms beside the ice machine. Because of I was living with an ice bag on my knee every night, so and I should have stopped everything else. But as an incurable optimistic, is that the good side of it is that when after 3 years Formula One didn't work anymore, I had a nice motorway in front of me with an unbelievable career. And honestly, I would change my career with very, very few people, not in terms of success, obviously, but I was lucky to enjoy so much every single category and championship. And nearly every year, but one or two, I was driving a car which was capable to win. And I remember I had a conversation with Eddie Cheever, who we nearly grew up together in Rome. And he was doing many years in Formula One, and I, you know, he's kind of proud of himself, Eddie, as an attitude, and I like that. No, he is, and but then I thought inside of me, we were talking about the careers. I said, you know what, I didn't tell him, but I thought I wouldn't change it, because to fight for victory, even if it's a lower category, yeah, is an unbelievable feeling, and so, yeah. You people who are listening can't see, but I'm smiling, because at the end of the day, it could have been a lot worse, you know, without world championships or Grand Prix wins.
You've done nothing but smile since you walked in. It's great. Did you think that maybe the... Because I think it was in 1987, John McDonald, Middlebridge, there was a Benetton, which was going to be... Was it Trussardi jeans?
Absolutely.
We saw pictures of it in black and white, and it wasn't allowed... They wouldn't give it an entry, but that was going to be your Formula One break.
Yes.
Did you think the chance had gone after that, maybe?
No, actually, you know what I... The thing I remember best about this whole story, which was very long because it was always maybe tomorrow, John McDonald's saying, be patient. I was probably calling him twice a day, I can't remember, but all he said was, be patient. And it didn't work, but in fact, 87, it was a little disappointing because 86 was my last Formula 3000 year. Being my second, it really made not so much sense to continue, and it didn't quite work for Formula One. So, but I was so happy with BMW, with Schnitzer, with Ravaglia. That was such a beautiful time of my life to race in the World Endurance World Touring Car Championship. That I said, okay, I didn't get to Formula One, but I'm still enjoying and it works. And then at the end of 87, I got a telephone call from my good friend buddy Stefan Johansson, who said, you know, Emanuele, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm just driving around. He was driving McLaren at the time. And I said, Philip Morris wants to do a commercial in Phoenix 1 week with the McLaren, and Alan Prost can't do it. And Ron is looking for a driver to drive the car around. Would you like to come? He's going to pay you. And I said, yes, sure, why not? You know, I come. So we went. We had a good time, of course, because it's quite difficult not to have a good time when Stefan and I are together. And then Ron said, you know, we are just about, they were running Porsche engine or TAG engine. Yeah, yeah. We just made the deal with Honda, and we have to set a test team in Suzuka because Honda wants to develop the engine. So we will send a car and a test team there, and we're looking for a driver. If you're interested. At the time, there was no test driver role, so he actually said to me, I don't know what this will lead to, but at least it'll give you the opportunity to drive with two top guys, Prost and Senna, and he said, we'll give you an option, but it's going to be quite hard to replace them, but at least, you know, he said, I think you should take it. So I said, yes. So I took my suitcase. I went to live in Japan. And this was an unbelievable time because I learned a lot from Prost and Senna, not how to drive, because I think this is the only thing that cannot be really taught. But I thought by driving as fast as I could, this was all I had to do in motor racing. And by working close to these two people, I really learned that there are a lot of other things that a great champion is having more than the others. You know, commitment, dedication, attention to details, ability to get the other people involved and giving their best. And they were doing everything better than me. Some things I couldn't do it because by default, but a lot of other things I actually could. So this was a breakthrough in my life, actually.
Emanuele, can I just cut in there? How are they different in terms of what you learned
both.
From them? Yeah.
Well, they were quite different. I think this that chemistry very unlikely will happen again because they were so different. There was hate and maybe even love, because actually years later you could also say love. I think what I liked about in Ayrton Senna was the intensity that he had, which I tried to imitate, but of course I could never get any close. He was giving everything he had, and he was showing. Now what I don't like about modern racing, modern especially Formula One, is drivers don't really, they actually tend to hide what they give, the emotions. They feel it like a sign of weakness in a way. So you see at the end of the race, I'm sure they're tired, although Michael Schumacher once told me that now after a Grand Prix he could start one and in the old days he was really finished, so probably the cars were more demanding before physically, but you know, Senna, he wasn't hiding anything, and I think this is one of the reasons why people identified themselves with him. Alan Prost was essential. and he was unbelievably fast and looking unbelievably slow. And actually, when he looked fast, he was rather slow. When he looked slow, he was very fast. And to me, I think because they didn't feel I was a threat, which is not really very good for me to say, but let's say maybe this is wrong. But they were both very nice. They treat me like they maybe felt a little pity in a way because I was there hoping and working hard. And actually, what we did in Suzuka, every second week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, so many miles, so much pain because the car, again, for me, wasn't that comfortable. So bruises loneliness and everything. But of course, it's been an incredible period of my life, which I thank God and Ron in the same order. So they probably felt a little bit sorry and pity, and this is why they were both very nice.
Let's not put Ron too close to God, eh? Anyway, can I just come in with a question? Because we've had a question sent in from Alan McNish.
The real Alec McNish?
Yes, the real, all the way from Malaysia, where he's supposed to be concentrating on his job with the BBC, but he's obviously had time to have a look at the Motorsport website. And he says, his question to you, Manueli, is, did you enjoy racing in America, Europe or Japan most of all, and why?
Well, first, let me say I'm really happy and proud that Alan took his time to write a question. Alan is a special person to me. I felt a lot of sympathy for him before he joined Audi because he drove for Onyx, and I thought, you know, I liked him. Then he came to Audi, and I was very happy that he came. But somehow things didn't work for some misunderstanding first, and then because of our both strong personality and strong will to succeed. So we got a lot of friction for many years, a lot of friction. Mm. I always respected him and rate him very highly, but he was my nightmare, and maybe I was his nightmare. Yes. Maybe this is too much, but we didn't really like each other. And then I remember we had one trip in Florida. We drove together the car for quite a long time, and we both wanted to get close to each other because we were quite mature, and then we both probably inside of us felt it's stupid. And then this trip was really helpful, and at the end I said, you know, Alan, I like you very much, and I always did. And he looked at me and said, you know, Manuel, me too. And then since then we became good friends, and I really rate him very, very highly. Going back to the question, racing in America has been a very valuable time of my career and life, because the sports cars I've driven, especially the R8, are extremely enjoyable sports cars. You could push really, really, really. Yeah. So much with these cars. The tires, I don't want to be like the American guys, you know, I want to thank Michelin, I want to thank this, I want to thank my mama, but the Michelin tires were so good that you didn't have to think about saving the tires. They kept the performances all the whole stint and even more. So for a racing driver to be able to push, the only worry was to be as fast as you could. It's a big thing. The American circus, as much as I am, of course, I'm a big fan of security. I'm actually involved in safety in different areas now in motorsport with FIA and with my federation and so on. But the American circuits are really great because they're old-fashioned. The tarmac is rough. They are more dangerous. They are more like probably similar to our circuits 20, 30 yeah. years ago, with all respect. And this gave us drivers an incredible pleasure of driving. Overtaking was something new to me, but I've never been actually a very good overtaker in my career. My perfect race was starting in the lead and walking away. When I was starting behind, I never really felt comfortable. Timing of overtaking was never good. And then racing in America, I think now I'm a pretty good overtaker. Again, being immodest, but I learned, it really taught me a lot about timing. The people there are nice, the fans were nice. And actually before, to be perfectly honest, by talking to drivers who raced in America before me, and they said, they spoke very well about raising in America. I inside of me, I thought, yeah, you say that because you have no more chance in Europe, and this is why probably not true. It was a very enjoyable. Japan, it was different, but again, I really like to learn from people. You know, Japanese people are really nice, and culture is so different. Racing, it's at a very high level. They have good circuits, and they have unbelievable tires. Now, for the sake of being fair, but Bridgestone tires in Formula 3000, the development of Bridgestone of tires was at its best. Because of the tires, the Formula 3000 were very close to Formula 1. Yeah. And so, unbelievable feeling of driving. And again, those 2 years were very important to my career. And it's a step that many people did. Yes, I actually have a story. Because I had a bicycle. We were all living in the President Hotel in Tokyo, all the gaijins, which it means all the foreign people. And I bought this red bicycle, which then I left it in heritage. And I think Autosport magazine wrote an article a few years later because it's been used by all the champions.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Noé d'Irvine, Jacques Villeneuve, and all the champions that came. And then the bicycle had been stolen two times, and two times has been returned. So I think this bicycle should deserve a place in the Museum of Motorsport somehow.
Motorsport Hall of Fame, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we should put your bicycle in the Hall of Fame. I think it's a very good idea.
Sorry, looking at your sort of career and how, you know, you were doing all the touring cars while doing Formula One, and, you know, mentioning there how great it was to go and experience the tracks in America and things. Do you think modern drivers are just too focused on Formula One? You know, all the young drivers coming up, and some of them will pass up a sports car drive just to stay at a sort of a back of the field team in Formula One.
My answer is yes. And as I said before, I'm afraid people who race today, they cannot experience the fun and the joy. Not that before we weren't trying hard, and not that before we weren't committed, but somehow, let's say, a more relaxed spirit, a more joyful spirit was tolerated. Now I think there's a lot of also image. You almost can't allow yourself to enjoy yourself. And as I said, winning is very, very important. So I think in Formula One, there are drivers who have an incredible ability, but they are in the back of the grid. I don't want to mention names. There are drivers really, really good, and maybe they will never have the pleasure of doing races where they can fight for the win. And also, I think driving different cars is makes your life your career more accomplished. I really learned a lot of versatility by jumping from one car to another from scratch, sometimes straight into qualifying. And it's also another way of developing yourself. Probably now everything is it's more at a higher level. So I think to be good, you have to be closer to the to the absolute limit than before. But actually, I'm happy, and I would even have liked to have started a little earlier in my career. problem is now they make a lot more money, but you know, our beloved Dr. Jon, who is our Audi doctor since many years, kept saying the last suit has got no pockets, you know, so money at the end of the day.
Okay, let's put some readers' questions to you, because we've had a lot of questions from our Motorsport magazine readers, which is always very, very gratifying, and you've obviously got a lot of fans out there, I must say.
Thank you so much.
Sorry, Manuel, I've lost my place.
Rob is no, I've found fiddling my around with his papers.
You lost your slot.
Just let me talk about one thing while I think about it. A couple of weeks ago on TV, they showed the entire 1989 race in Adelaide, and I was there, so I remember how bad it was. But even so, I watched it and I thought, Jesus, was it really like this?
Yes,
the fact that race was ever even started.
In fact, what I remember is that we all, after the formation lap, we went to on the start and finish, and there was Bernie, and more or less we all said it's very, very difficult to drive. Mainly because of the sprays on the straight, and because of the fact that you couldn't go flat out on the straight, so you had to adjust the speed according to the aquaplaning, and because you were completely blind, you could find a car actually going 20-30 miles an hour slower in front of you because you didn't have enough grip enough on the straight. And funny enough, just 3 or 4 days ago, I had a dinner with Riccardo Patrese, and he really he was very mad at me because on the straight I hit him, because he was just going a little slower than me, and when he appeared, it was too late. So it was really, really bad. And I have two memories there. One is that I actually probably did the only rolling start in the history of Formula One, because I have to say, amongst my few qualities, I don't have the one to be fast in doing things. So when Bernie said, okay, now it's enough, in like 5 minutes it's red, green flag, and by the time I walked to the car and I belted myself, everybody was gone. So I was kind of catching up in the formation lap, and when I got and there was Rory Byrne on the radio, speed up, speed up, speed up, they're starting. So by the time I got to the last hairpin, the race had started, and I started like a rolling start. And the other thing is, actually, I almost insulted myself, because I think it was too dangerous, especially on the straight, you know. Not too dangerous, just too silly, because you were trying to adapt your speed according to the sound of the engine of the car in front of you. Am I too close? The sound was too... And then I was telling myself, like insulting myself, because I was not courageous enough to say stop. And sometimes you have to be brave to say stop, and hats off for Niki Lauda,
In fact, I mean, Prost did stop at the end of the first lap of that race, and Gerhard has said to me that, he said before the race, I agreed with Alain, yeah, I'll do the same. And he said, if ever I was ashamed of anything in my life, it was that.
I don't remember
this
background.
At the end of
background.
The first lap, he said, I saw Alain go in, and he said, and I knew I should do the same. And he said, I just wasn't brave enough to do it.
No, I really mean it. You know, sometimes you think you need to be brave to do something, but maybe this is more stupidity than courage. And the real courage that you need is to quit when you think something is not
feasible. Well, especially
feasible.
When you're about to win the world championship, possibly.
Yes, yes.
Let's get.
I could test this feeling, you know.
Let's get into some readers' questions, because they take a lot of trouble to send them in. This comes from... Ed, but not our. It's not our Ed. It's another Ed.
Yes, yeah, that's not
yes,
me.
It's yes, okay. Me. He wants to know, Manuel, do you agree or disagree with Mr. Baretsky that noise is wasted energy in motor racing? So a lot of us love the noise. Noise is very topical right now, isn't it?
Well, it's
been
a very
diesel
actual,
for several years.
Very actual topic. I admire and rate Mr. Baretsky very, very much. And I think from a pure engineering point of view, I think he's right. Actually, the noise or the not noise of the Audi, I think is a very, very nice noise, because you really feel the power, you really feel the wind. personally, I have to say, I never really liked so much the noise of the Formula One cars of today with 18 or 20,000 RPM. I always felt it's a little bit too much. I prefer more bass, more V8, something which is more kind of vibrating than this high frequency. But I'm not saying that now I like the Formula One noise of today, but I think quality and quantity, they don't always go together. Yeah. So not the louder, the better. But I think it's a question of taste, actually. But what to cut the story short, the engineers are unbelievable people. My dream was to be an engineer in my next life, and so I admire them a lot. But sometimes things have to be done with some emotions. So I think I disagree with what he says at the end of the day.
Okay, good answer. We have to ask an Italian this. And this one comes from Mario Carneiro Neto in Brazil. And he wants to know, do you think Ferrari will come back to Le Mans? And if so, would you love to get involved with that?
Was it do I hope or do I think? Do I hope? Yes, of course, because I think every good manufacturer must race in Le Mans right now for many reasons. Do I think? I'm afraid I would say no.
Really?
Yes, because Le Mans now, I think it's a commitment in terms of commitment, technology, investments, no second to Formula One. And if you think being a successful Formula One team that with your left hand in the back of your body you can build a competitive Le Mans car, I think it's underestimating the difficulties. And probably when they will do a feasible research of feasibility. Sorry about my English, but you know, once they look deep into it, probably they will find out that they need almost as big operation as a Formula One team. I really, really hope I'm wrong, because imagine how much benefit we will all have from a Ferrari prototype. But imagine how many critics. Imagine if now there was a Le Mans operation. If now Ferrari would be also developing a Le Mans car,
right. Impossible.
People would say, "You see, they're doing a Le Mans car, they don't win in Formula One." Yeah. I really hope I'm wrong, but I'll be surprised.
I mean, knowing what you know about the Audi setup, how long do you think it might take Porsche to get a win at Le Mans? Because you were talking earlier a lot about how long it takes to build that kind of incredible teamwork.
Exactly. The way I saw it, now we know a little bit more, but I don't want to really go in details about what I heard about testing and what I know. But what I thought before was, I think it wouldn't be that difficult for Porsche to build a car nearly equivalent to in terms of performance of an Audi, because there's a lot of technology available in the world. If you have the budget, there's a lot of good people. So with a good manager and recruiting the right people, theoretically it's possible to build a top class product. What you cannot buy, not even with MasterCard, is the experience on track. And I think for this, everybody who comes in has to pay a duty, because Rome has not been built in one day, and the quality that of on track operation and of preparation that combination of Joost and Audi have, you just cannot buy. Simply, you cannot buy. You need to go there and slowly learn. And so this is the way I see it. Some people can be maybe as fast, but to be as successful, you can win a race because, you know, things can work, but on long term, it takes a little while.
Okay, let's take one from Avinash, and he wants to know, what's going on with Italian racing drivers? I mean, there hasn't been an Italian Grand Prix driver since 2012?
Yeah, but...
And where are all the Italian drivers?
Well, it's an interesting statistic.
They're on the road, breaking the speed limits.
Well, that's
in the motorway.
Okay. But, I mean, it's an interesting statistic. I mean, Italy had a fantastic body of drivers right from the very pioneering days of motor racing, Nuvolari to the 30s. They won three of the first four world championships. And when we first met in the mid-80s, I mean, European F3, Formula 2, Formula 3000... was full of young Italians.
Absolutely. And go-kart, actually.
Yeah, and karting as well. But, I mean, there were some really good ones, Capelli, Modena, yourself, etc. But, you know, no world champions is 53.
I ask myself this question nearly every day because I would love to see young Italians. And I don't really have an answer. Some answers are... right now there is no structure to bring up drivers, but on the back of my heart I always thought if you are a very good driver, even if you are a very good driver, you need some luck. But if you are an outstanding driver, I think people like Senna, people like Prost, people like Clark, these some really outstanding drivers, even with no luck, even if they were born in Zimbabwe, with all respect for Zimbabwe, somehow they found a way to show their abilities. So probably Italy never had one driver of this caliber, but I think Italy had drivers who could, with a little bit of luck, win a world championship, and they wouldn't have taken away from anybody. And I think about Elio De Angelis, for instance, who was standing Ayrton Senna's speed when Ayrton Senna was a potentially good driver, but not the Ayrton Senna of today. And I think Elio, if he didn't die, he could have won a championship. Michele Alboreto, with some good luck. I don't talk about the people who are no longer with us just because I feel sorry for them. I really mean it. Michele, with a little bit of luck, he could have won a championship. And some others who maybe didn't even win a Grand Prix, Stefano Modena, God knows. I feel people also, to be a real champion, you need some strength inside, you need some hunger. And maybe Italians, as by default, maybe we are too, our mama is always looking after us, and maybe we don't really have this big hunger. I don't know, but right now there is a major problem. There are no structure. I was so lucky because Philip Morris was helping us a lot in our time. And now there is Red Bull, but it's far away from Italy. Philip Morris, there was an Italian branch which was very successful. So a lot of people, Andrea De Cesaris, you guys can name them better than me, Alex Caffi.
A
whole generation came up thanks to Philip Morris. But it's sad because we have so many manufacturers. And as I said before, in karting, all the top manufacturers in karting are Italians. And in my time, there were a lot of Italians who were at the top of karting. Now there are not even...
When Andrea Gilardi won the World Karting Championship, he beat Michael Schumacher and Alan McNish.
Yes.
You can look back on those karting statistics. And so I've got to move on, though, because we're running out of time, which is really sad. We could stay here all night. This comes from Diego Ruiz, and he wants to know, what was the scariest moment you've ever had in a racing car?
Well, maybe outside the racing car was when I got stuck in the toilet before the start of a go-kart race in Jesolo near Venezia, which was very far away from Rome, so early days of my career. We were all on a starting grid, ready to go, and of course I had the last-minute pit stop to do. So I went, and the main toilet was closed, so I went to the secondary toilet behind the grandstand. And I closed it. I don't tell you how dirty it was, but basically I closed the door and I pulled the handle, and the handle stayed in my hand, and the pin fell from on the other side. And so I was hearing, Emanuele Pirro è fregato di andare alla partenza. Emanuele Pirro. I was shouting, and nobody was basically. And my dad was so mad at me, you cannot believe. And I was so mad at me, but they basically, I couldn't start. Okay, this is a joke because seriously, unfortunately, I've seen people killed and these were scary. But I have to say, I've always been quite aware of the risks of motor racing, which probably stopped me from daring a little bit more, let's say. But when somebody got killed, I never had the instinct of saying, oh, now I stop. Wow, motor racing is dangerous. Because I knew it before. But, you know, when, for instance, Michele got the accident, was one of the worst time of my life. When I saw Jean-Louis Lafosse being killed in my first Le Mans, we were talking about Le Mans, but then we got carried away. I did Le Mans in 1981, and I drove one stint. In that only one stint, I saw Jean-Louis Lafosse being killed, and we were passing by on the straight over the debris for several laps behind the pace car. Then there was one lap of green, and the next lap Thierry Boutsen with the WM crashed on the straight. He was okay, but I think one marshal was killed, and it was full of I don't want to say the details, but no, this sure, was very
sure,
shocking.
Sure. But please don't scare yourself at Goodwood this weekend.
Oh, I try not, and actually we've been laughing so much and having such a good time that we cannot complete the interview talking about this accident.
We're
so
not,
we need one more question,
we're not,
please.
We're, no, don't worry. We're not going to end on that note. Don't worry.
Actually, can I just go back to the young driver thing? You've got Italy at the moment. You've got Raffaele Marcello, who's backed by Ferrari. He's in GP2 with the Champion Team Racing Engineering. How much do you know about him? I mean, is he a solid prospect?
Yes, and then there's also Antonio Fuoco. People say very, very high things about him. So these two guys could be.
So all hope is not lost.
Our potential future. Somehow, I think in a way, myself and people of my generation have been somehow responsible because we've been so, our longevity has been so long that we probably stopped the very next generation to come up because we kind of hanged on for a long time. But Raffaele, he's lucky actually that he's racing now because he's taller than me, and if he would have been driving 20 or 30 years ago, he could only be a good touring car driver. So and Antonio Fuoco, both are really, really good. And yeah, we need one Italian. Forgive me. I mean, you British had a lot of world champions, and it would be nice to have one.
Hey, we're more than happy to have Italian drivers on the grid.
Grazie.
Don't worry
grazie,
about
grazie.
It.
Grazie.
And really, well, actually, while we're talking about Italian drivers, the one guy we didn't mention earlier on was Sandro Nannini. Tell us a Nannini story.
If Sandro, I mean, you know, you cannot have everything in life, and probably people extraordinary like maybe Michael Schumacher or Ayrton Senna. I think to succeed you need a large variety of characteristics at the highest possible level. It's like winning a bingo. Sometimes somebody is born with a lot of these characteristics all at a high level. If Sandro had one or two more, he would have been an unbelievable champion because he had such a natural instinct of driving, which probably he didn't even know himself how he was doing, that I guess he was second to none. Maybe like Maradona, you know, these people who, they don't know why, but they can do it exceptionally well.
Messi, even with 30 years.
I think Messi knows what he's doing.
But Messi doesn't go through 30 espressos and 60 cigarettes a day.
Yes, this is, I mean, we were at Benetton one year, and okay, unfortunately I had not much time to do fitness because I was basically on the road all the time, but I really felt I should have done more, and every minute I had free, I tried to do something, and then I see this guy who was most of the times quicker than me. His fitness was espresso. When he was tired, one more espresso. It's sad because these people, I don't know if motor racing will has got room for these people. You know, Andrea De Cesaris is another unbelievable talent. These people were so different, so unique, so special, so, but yet so good, you know.
Okay, good. That just about wraps up our readers' questions. So why don't we just do one lap at the table before we go? It's been great having you here, Manuele, I must say. Best fun we've had for a long time. Nigel, from your vast memory bank. Let me start then, because you drove for Mike Earle for some time, and I'm just down the road from where we're sitting.
Oh yeah, every time I pass by Sign Bognor Ridges, this was the beginning of my dream, you know. And and actually Mike was he's a really cool guy, and incredible memories. I've been with him 3 years. So he was patient and good enough to keep me for 3 years, and really, really unbelievable. Even with the two mechanics we had, and Formula 2, which was a really nice time, because in those years Formula 2 was really a nice car to drive. Mm-hmm. When I'm asked which is the best car you ever drove, I always name three: the Formula 2 of that year, the March 842, and Audi R8 and the McLaren MP44. This March, it was so nice, and the new Formula 3000 was so bad at the beginning, because nobody had experience with ground effect, and it was such a step backwards in terms of pleasure. But Mike, really good time. Thanks, Mike, for holding on to me, and every time I see him, it's nice.
I think he does listen, because he winds me up sometimes about it. But just to explain to all of you listening out there, we're talking about my girl, who ran David Purley and Derek Bell and people in Bognor Regis, and then went on to do the Onyx Formula One team. Okay, Simon.
Going back to those days, Formula 2, Formula 3000, they were my first years on the road as an international reporter. And it was a very, as you said, it was a very happy time. I mean, the motor racing seemed more relaxed. I know it was serious on the track, but the atmosphere in the paddock was lovely. Are there any particularly good anecdotes you remember from that time? I mean, I remember Beppe Gabbiani doing the drive shafts on two of Mike Earle's marches in about three laps at NO one year. But I mean, what, and he's your teammate. But I mean, what are your best anecdotes from that time?
Well, anecdotes, my memory is not that good, but you were talking about atmosphere, and actually it was, we were all good friends, but another guy who was, I had a great admiration, and I had, I rate him very, very highly as a driver and as a person, but we were big enemies, was Mike Thakwell. And he was so strange, this guy. I would like to meet him, actually.
He
now
still is.
Yes, I know.
Still is strange.
He's one of the most talented person, together probably with Alain Ferté, that didn't make to Formula One. Came across in my career.
He lives just down the road from here.
Yeah, I know he runs a bar, and I wonder whether if I once go there, he will buy me a beer or will charge it. I don't know. Or double now, I don't think
there's
so.
There's one way to find out.
Yes, exactly. But I remember we were in Pergusa, very hot, and of course there was no catering there, like now. So we left lunchtime the truck to go somewhere in a Sicilian restaurant, and Mike was just not far from the gate where Tim Rolt was, and he was sitting in a chair looking at the ground, thinking. He wasn't sleeping, he was just looking down. We went for lunch, and you know, Sicilian lunch are not the fastest one. I came back, and the guy was still in the same position.
Okay, Ed, quickly. By the way, but we just should say that Ed Foster is racing at Goodwood this weekend. So well done, Ed. Have a great time, and be careful.
I'll definitely be being careful. You sort of touched on it.
Yeah, another advice. Don't trust the people who tell you that Ford Water is flat.
I'm only in an MGB, so I think it will be.
Maybe it's flat, but yeah. My my very first test in a race car, Formula Fiat Albert, car was delivered, all 50 drivers in Mugello, and one senior driver told me, Arrabbiata 1, oh sure, it's no problem, flat, and it was going from 5th to 4th, one gear down, and I was not bad in the ranking, so if he tells me, so I couldn't make it, so I just split my body in two, you know, because my foot was just lifting off by itself, so I pretend I was only owning half of the body. I forgot about, I just fired my right leg for the time being, and I did one of the biggest crash of my life. So first lesson motor racing taught me was don't believe to what drivers tell. So this is the advice I'm
giving.
We're
going around in second gear at this rate. you touched on it briefly earlier, but you obviously love driving historic so much now, and you know, you had such a long and varied race career. Do you sometimes wish you were born in a different era and you could have sampled, whether it was Group C cars or, you know, anything?
Again, I don't like to look back, because I'm really, really happy with what I had, but probably yes. I really admire racing of the 60s. These drivers were heroes to me, more than anybody else. So the 60s and beginning of the 70s for me was the most unbelievable time. And I think, Nigel, you are very young, but a little bit older than me, and you have witnessed motor racing from a little bit before me, and I think this time was must have been
I can see you in a Maserati 250F easily.
Yeah, maybe I should. I had to learn how to smoke, which is something I don't like.
have you ever driven a 250F?
No.
No, I just wondered if maybe an opportunity had come along.
I would love,
try and do that.
I would love. And every time, in fact, I was lucky enough to drive several times the Auto Union. Tazio Nuvolari is actually my hero. When I was born, when I was a kid, I was given a book of Nuvolari. And his story, his braveness, his courage, his attitude captured me very early. And he had a phrase on his overall, which I put on the back of my helmet since the beginning of my racing, and I had it all through my career. Which was there was a holy heart, a heart with the holy cross of Christ, and it was written in Italian, but then translated in English. You will be with me in a danger and in a victory, and I really liked this phrase. And when I started racing several years later, I painted in the back of my helmet, and I had it all the way through. So these people, these cars, must have been so cool to drive.
Tell me what the Auto Union was like.
Actually, I drove it several times, but the time I enjoyed the most was at the Nürburgring, because the new Nürburgring, the Grand Prix circuit, so very flat, so you didn't really have to be extra careful. Runoff areas, you could push, you know, quite in a nice way. And one feeling was, first, you know, the way the car is built, the welding, the way they were treating the metal, it's such an advanced engineering for that time. So even looking at it, and it wasn't easy, it wasn't difficult to drive, of course, in the circumstances, with bad roads, with trees, but it's a straightforward car. The only thing is you're sitting so much in front of the car, yeah, that when you drift, the car goes very easily into drift, and actually you can brake in drifting, you know. You brake, turn, and you enter nearly like a go-kart. Yeah. Pretty straightforward. But you have to be careful, because the back end overtakes you, because the back end is so far away, so you don't move so much, and yet the car does a big drift angle, you know. So this is the thing that I had to be careful, because when I realized how many meters the rear end was, I thought, wow. But for me, the big thing was the ergonomics. They were so wrong. The driver was sitting in such an uncomfortable position. Mm. So straight, and you had to hold on the steering wheel, which the steering wheel moves a lot. If they only knew how to sit the driver in a more efficient and comfortable position, they would have probably gained a lot. But hats off. I mean, these people, yeah, it's a huge emotions and huge respect for these
people.
They
were brave.
Yes. Skillful and brave. And there is a big difference. You know, sometimes people say, who is the best driver of all times? I think this is a useless exercise, because I think ability has grown, as in every other sport. You know, when you see football players, best football players playing, even Pelé, he looks nearly like an amateur compared to the football of today. So the skill of performance in a sport have been always increasing. But what for me at the time, the very, very difficult thing was you were not forgiven, you know. You couldn't afford to make a mistake. So you had to play with this fine balance of you could, yeah. This was the really difficult thing. And even my time in F1 in the 80s, of course you were pushing as hard as you can, but you had to keep a little bit of a safe margin in downshifting, in driving, because if you were at 99.9%, one corner you would crash, like now, one corner they would go wide, or one corner they would miss the apex, one corner they lock the brakes. Now, because of the circumstances, because of the circuits, they can afford and they are obliged to go a lot closer to the physical limits than before.
We need to be careful here, or we're going to get into the area of Grand Prix stewards. And I don't think we want to go there today.
Oh, it's fine to me. It's fine. I'm comfortable, because I feel I do it with genuinity, with commitment, with passion, and with without being biased. So I'm not in nobody's payroll. I've had a lot from motor racing. I don't need anybody. Everybody is a friend. Sure. So, and I really, really commit myself the best I can. Sometimes you wish you are not sitting in this room, like last weekend in Australia when we had to disqualify poor Ricciardo. But at the end of the day, I'm really convinced that what I do is correct, or at least I do it in goodwill, and this makes me relief from sometimes the pressure.
You should start fining people, the winner, £5,000 if they don't stand up in the car on the slowing down. That's what you should do.
There are a lot of contradictions in people's life, and I'm a big example, I have to say.
Okay, I think bravo, well done, fantastic.
No, I want to thank you. Really, you guys are my heroes, and it's been a great honor to share this hour with you. And I really hope that people who are listening capture the joy, the passion that we all have. And we got a few more wrinkles in our eyes because we've been laughing the whole time and smiling.
There's not enough laughter in life. Okay, and they're going to have a great time listening to this. We know they are. Thank you so much. Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.
Fantastic.
Thanks, really.
Okay, that really is all we have time for. We'll be back next month with our Motorsport Magazine podcast May edition, which will feature James Weaver and Andy Wallace. Weaver and Wallace come to the podcast. That should be fun too. Okay, thank you very much, everybody, for listening, and thank you so much, Manuele, for popping in on your way from Rome to Goodwood. Wonderful.
I'll have two good questions, for one for James and one for Andy.
Okay.
Already they're here, ready.
Okay. You send them in, we'll ask them. Fantastic. Okay. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.